This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
Developing countries are now beginning to take off on their development. They need energy. Energy relies on fossil fuel. If you ask them to cut back on that fossil fuel now drastically, it'll impact on their development, it'll impact on their poverty reduction and the other social and other programs. So it has to be done in a way that is compatible with the continuing development. And the only way that can be done is, therefore, for developing countries to provide finance with regard to reducing this without impairing their development, providing technology, transferring technology, and also capacity building so developing countries can then begin to do this.
Implementation is a global package, and cooperation between the developed and the developing world is crucial for any climate policy implementation to be a success. In the previous episode, we were joined by Professor Gurdial Singh Nijjar and His Excellency Christophe Penot to discuss the common but differentiated responsibilities of developed and developing countries. However, how will these responsibilities be executed? In order to make the necessary shifts and implement greener policies, developing countries require sufficient funding, technologies and institutional capacity, and developed countries need to accept their responsibilities and help. Welcome to the third episode of COP21, where we explore another pivotal issue for the COP21 negotiations in Paris, which is implementation. What is the importance of building finances, technology and capacity in order for policies to be implemented? Sivan Karta, senior scientist at the Stockholm Environmental Institute, draws a link between finances and cooperation.
Finance is important in a climate agreement basically because we're trying to tackle a global problem which can only really be addressed if it's done in a real cooperative way among all countries. And countries just vary so much in their level of development. Developed countries have a much higher proportion of capacity and responsibility to solve the problem. So the only way that that circle can be squared is if there are cooperative mechanisms whereby the countries that need to undertake the emission reductions, at least in part, have available financial and technological support from the countries who have a lot of responsibility and capacity for dealing with the problem.
When we talk about large emissions from developing countries, we often think of the Asian tigers, China and India. As the region's fastest growing economies and biggest emitters, how does the Green Climate Fund relate to them? Should they be receiving equal funds or be expected to sustain themselves without the help of developed countries?
There is a pretty wide range of countries that, you know, by my own reckoning, would deserve to get financial and technological support, including even India and China. I think that both of them, China in particular, has made quite significant strides as far as starting to clean up its power sector and as far as starting to invest, you know, quite substantially in renewable energy like solar and wind. But at the same time, the demands that climate is putting on us right now really are, you know, quite stark. That if we were serious about keeping warming, you know, below 2 degrees, then that really would suggest that, and I'm drawing this from the IPCC, which had a convenient chart where they showed this, it would require that all countries peak their emissions pretty soon. So instead of emissions continuing to rise, they would start to fall. For countries of Asia, for example, in India and China, emissions would have to peak around 2020 or shortly after. And so that's a time frame where they are still in a pretty radically different stage of development than the developed countries, than the EU, than the U.S. China's income will be something like a third or a quarter of the United States income. India's income will be something like one-tenth of the United States income. India actually, it so turns out, will be at the same income when its emissions need to peak that the United States was at in roughly the 1890s. And so that means it will need to be reducing its emissions at a rapid rate, at the same level of development when the United States had just realized that industrialization fueled by fossil fuel was its route out of poverty. That's the way it was going to industrialize and create jobs. And India will need to be reducing emissions at the same rate that we were increasing emissions. And so put that way, to me at least, it makes perfect sense that even a country like India deserves to have financial and technological support to help it through that that transition.
It goes without saying that the green shift is going to be a difficult one. The fear of hindering economic development stands as an obstacle for many developing countries hoping to curb their emissions. Why is this the case? Some, particularly the powerful, have a lot to lose.
This is quite a significant transformation. It's a transformation from one entire sort of energy economy to another one, from a fossil-based energy economy to a low-carbon energy economy. And in any such transition, there will be, in some ways, winners and losers. There will be certain actors, certain corporations, certain stakeholders that have something to gain, say those who are involved in producing or implementing the solutions that we'll need, like wind power, solar power, energy efficiency, public transit. And there will be other actors that have a lot to lose in this situation. There are many extremely powerful actors right now who are powerful because they have a key role in our current energy economy. Companies that are producing and selling oil or gas and making changes when there are politically powerful actors that are reluctant to make those changes is difficult.
The Green Climate Fund agreed upon in Cancun was established under the UNFCCC for developed countries to provide developing countries with funds to mitigate and adapt to climate change. The agreement decided on a $100 billion mark, but where are we in terms of reaching that mark? Hela Shekruhu, Executive Director of the Green Climate Fund, explains in an interview with France 24.
As we stand, there is approximately $10 billion that have been pledged to the fund, of which six are already signed. And these are to be invested over a period of 3 to 4 years. So that means channeling up to $2.5 billion a year. Now, that's a good start. It's a very promising start, but it still falls short of being the significant share of the $100 billion per year that is required in the Green Climate Fund. The developing countries count a lot on the Green Climate Fund to be a significant contributor to that.
The Green Climate Fund is, however, reaching out to different types of markets to create more resources for the fund's initiatives.
The Green Climate Fund is the first climate fund which has a dedicated private sector facility up front as part of the structure of the fund. And we are already partnering with a number of private sector entities. Deutsche Bank, Acumen Fund have been accredited by the board of the fund as entities that can take resources from the Green Climate Fund and deploy them, in co-financing and in catalyzing additional private investments. So the financial and the private players out there, as you mentioned, they have a lot of liquidity, which is not yielding enough revenues, but they want to find the right risk-adjusted returns. And the Green Climate Fund has that risk-bearing capacity when working with the private sector to take the tranche of investment that is right now acting as a bottleneck. So we can be the subordinated tranche, or we can be the completing part of equity, or we can provide a guarantee on a specific risk. And by doing that, I think we are seeing that it's an opportunity to multiply and channel long-term resources at much bigger scale towards these developing country opportunities.
As the first initiative of its kind, the Green Climate Fund inevitably has its flaws. Up next, we understand the fundamental challenges of the Green Climate Fund and what the developing world needs to do in order to mitigate and adapt to climate change. BFM 89.9. Welcome back to the third episode of COP21, where we have been discussing the means of implementation with regards to emission cuts. In the first part, we spoke about the primary challenges of shifting to greener policies and introduced the Green Climate Fund. The gap between what is required out of the Green Climate Fund and what's in play is prominent. Developed countries have an obligation to contribute to the fund, as Kumi Naidu, the executive director of Greenpeace International, points out in an interview with the IACC's Young Journalists on Vimeo.
Developing countries are not asking for charity, right? They are saying, pay your carbon debt. You carry a responsibility for the situation that you've put us in. You've built your economies in Europe, in Australia, in the US, in Canada, and so on, based on a particular energy choice that you all made, and you all told the rest of the world that that's the way to go, and we were following you. And now we find, decades ago, that this is not safe for our children and their future, and therefore it is completely justified that developing countries should receive substantial financial support from those nations that benefited most from the burning of fossil fuels.
So what's preventing us from reaching the $100 billion mark? Meena Raman from the Third World Network expresses her concerns.
Well, this is where we have a little bit of a problem, because what the developed countries are now saying is that about $60 billion has been mobilized in 2013 and 2014. They've come up with some recent study to show that they have actually done this. But the math does not add up. And many developing countries are challenging that claim, because what they are saying is that developed countries are beginning to add all the money that goes through the World Bank and the other multilateral development banks, which developed countries put money in. So they're counting that money as money for climate finance. And they're also counting loans to developing countries as finance. And they're mixing it up with what they call development assistance or development aid. So what many developing countries and many of us as civil society observers are saying is that there is actually a lot of cheating happening in terms of the numbers game. Because what in real effect developing countries want to see is what is the actual money that is flowing to developing countries, which is really climate finance, which is actually not development aid, but is new and additional, and what is it that actually really comes into the coffers of developing countries. I think this is where there is no clarity. And so at the moment, there is some kind of cheating game going on. As many people say, the numbers are out there, but there's no way to verify it. So this is one of the main problems. And whether indeed that $100 billion will come through is actually a test for Paris. Because if you already have an agreement that has decided previously that developed countries must bring forward this amount of money and they're not able to, then how do you talk about a post-2020 agreement, which is what Paris is about? The Paris Agreement, which will be concluded end of this year, is supposed to address what developing countries and developed countries will do post-2020. It's not pre-2020. So if the $100 billion, which is a pre-2020 commitment, is not even materializing, then the chances of seeing anything real post-2020 is really, really very low and very bleak. So I think this is one of the huge questions that will have to be answered when parties meet in Paris this next month.
Has this been stirred by a lack of trust among countries? In the first episode, we explained the loss of trust during COP15 in Copenhagen, and it seems like trust is a recurring issue, even in discussions on climate finance. Sivan suggests that a fundamental issue underlying the ineffective transfer of technologies and funds is the lack of trust amongst the countries involved.
I think that one of the fundamental problems here has been trust between countries and the feeling, particularly among countries of the South, that the developed countries are willing to earnestly contribute to providing resources. And perhaps there's distrust in the other direction, too, that the resources will be used effectively and that the results really will help as far as mitigation and adaptation. And I think that efforts by any countries to avoid contributing or to contribute, but, you know, maybe use, you know, questionable accounting practices, whether it's double counting or triple counting, or where it's aid money that's being shifted over, that will be problematic because, one, it will mean less real support is flowing, and two, I think it would further undermine trust.
Corruption and mismanagement of funds for personal gain by governments of developing countries is a chronic issue, as Kumi points out, and an issue he firmly believes must be dealt with strongly.
We have seen far too many corrupt governments in the developing world that actually have used public money for private gain. We now have to get fast to a point where there cannot be any impunity for people who steal 1 cent of public money, whether it is from the Green Climate Fund, whether it's from local tax money, or whether it is from any other aid source. We have to get to a point where we make it as difficult as possible and ultimately eliminate the high levels of corruption that we have.
Establishing trust between stakeholders is key. So how can developed countries ensure that the money that they invest into the Green Climate Fund is used in a productive and efficient way by developing countries?
These are issues which are currently being addressed both in the Climate Change Convention and also in the Green Climate Fund. The Green Climate Fund, for instance, there are policies that have evolved and they are also continuing to evolve. There has to be an evaluation of how developing countries are spending their money, what they call the accredited entities, which means entities which have been accredited to receive the money. They are responsible for ensuring that the money is spent correctly. There are also what they call fiduciary standards. There are standards that you have to follow, that there are procedures that one has to follow, and monitoring and evaluation mechanisms which are in place. So in that sense, I think it's important to realize that developing countries are also held accountable for the money that comes through the Green Climate Fund. Developing countries also have to come up with how much money they receive. They have to report on how they spent the money. So there are some accountability mechanisms there.
But is corruption only the fault of developing countries? Using his home continent of Africa as an example, Kumi points out that the collusion between developing and developed countries is a major factor in corrupt practices.
We should not think that the problem of money being stolen in developing countries is a problem simply of developing countries. Let's be very clear. When that money gets stolen, where does it go? Does it go to another developing country or does it land up in the bank accounts in Europe and other developed countries? Right? So I always say that, you know, Africa is one of the richest continents underneath the ground, and that's precisely why we are one of the poorest continents above the ground. But when we talk about corruption, we need to understand nobody in Africa would get away with the scale of corruption that we have on our continent if they did not have the collaboration, the participation, the collusion of powerful vested interests in so-called Western democracies who have provided a range of protection for these folks.
Mitigating and adapting to climate change is not a plain and simple investment process. Developed countries like Malaysia need to develop their ability to manage the funds and the technologies to protect our forests and sinks and cope with potential consequences. How do we do that? Mina suggests that national designated authorities need to involve all stakeholders and take advantage of our resources.
I think the very first fundamental requirement is really to have the climate action plans in place, both for mitigation. When we talk about mitigation, we refer to cuts in emissions, and then to ensure also that we don't deforest or we protect the forest resources that we have so they can operate as sinks for greenhouse gases. And the other aspect is actually to adapt to climate change, meaning when we face adverse impact, luckily Malaysia is not hit by cyclones so often, but we have had very extreme weather events which have led to massive flooding in the country. Now, those require systems in place and warning systems and as well as coping mechanisms and systems, which I think Malaysia is still not up to speed yet in terms of our adaptive capacity. And so the National Designated Authority has to ensure it uses this readiness money and resources to prepare to do the right thing and the right policy. And they can't just do this alone. They have to do it with stakeholders, whether it's genuine consultations with civil society organizations and communities, with the private sector as well, both the small and the medium and not just the big private sector. So there's a lot of work to do, and I think the Green Climate Fund is aware that this is how developing countries have to be capacitated. And I think it is by availing of these resources that we begin to learn.
Question is, are developing countries being equipped with the technologies to maximize their resources? The shortage of trust is bidirectional and relates also to the reluctance to provide developing countries with technologies. Why do we think this is the case? Both Sivan and Meena feel very similarly.
Many developed countries think of technology innovation and development as their comparative advantage and want to maintain that comparative advantage and think of international cooperation not in terms of cooperation as such, but in terms of expanding markets and finding more and bigger markets for their products. And so the notion of cooperation can feel quite threatening.
Threatening to what? Simple. Their economy.
Definitely. I think behind the fights that you see is the issue about competitiveness, you know. Developed countries hold on to their technologies and hold on to their advantage, and they don't want to have these technologies easily available for developing countries or affordable, so that they can sell them in as if it's that this is a market, where you buy and sell technologies. When we all recognize that climate change is a global problem, it's a global issue, and therefore there are responsibilities and there are legal obligations for developed countries. So in this sense, I think there is an economic reason for why developed countries want to have the upper end in terms of an economic advantage so that they are able to sell their technologies to the developing world, which is really unfair because then the developing countries will not be able to access or afford them in a cheap way.
Cooperation once again presents itself as a repeated theme, but until countries forfeit to this imagined competition, cooperation will remain a hypothetical situation. So what do we need to do? Where should developing countries be investing their funds in order to maximize their resources to adapt and mitigate climate change? And how should Malaysia be tackling this issue?
I think that a good place to start is by looking at the measures that will benefit the country in terms of air pollution, in terms of energy security, and especially in terms of expanding energy access to a broader spread of the population. Say, decentralized renewables for providing electrification to rural areas that are currently unelectrified. So first of all, take measures that are beneficial and that don't lock you into extremely carbon-intensive future growth paths. I think an important thing is that decisions be taken that do involve the participation of broad segments of the population that really are seen to be sort of democratically supported and have the investment and buy-in of people. It would likely to be ineffective if it's done in too top-down a way.
Meena adds on to this, highlighting the needs for a gap identification in order to determine our technology needs and capabilities.
For a country like Malaysia, we should begin to be aware of what are our gaps, what kind of technologies do we need, what are the gaps in our technology needs, what kinds of technology assessments we are capable of doing. And so even the gap identification is a very important part of that climate change action plan. And so these are steps that every country should follow. And even in adaptation, every country is encouraged to do what's called a national adaptation plan. And that national adaptation plan is also supposed to ascertain what our gaps are, what our needs are, what kind of assistance is needed, what kind of resources are needed. These are processes that are there in place, which we need to avail of and get our act together.
And what can Malaysia do to take the first steps?
There are areas where Malaysia can do more. one of the most important aspects is that how do we protect the remaining forests? How do we ensure that there is coherence in policy in terms of showing state governments that there can be resources from the international world through the Green Climate Fund or through other resources, say, from other banks and so on, where actually there is money to protect the forest. And these are what we call no-regret options, meaning you have to do them, you can do them, and there are rewards at the end of it. The other aspects, of course, is like mangrove forestry, because mangrove forests themselves are not only forests that protect the coastlines. They are actually, if you remember the Asian tsunami, which hit a few years ago, in many areas where mangrove forests were intact, the damage was much, much, much less. So these are natural barriers that can help, and they also help the fishing communities with fishery resources, and they are also a mitigator, meaning they absorb greenhouse gases. They are a sink as well. So the many ways in which we can use our natural ecosystems, these are areas that Malaysia can do. Same thing as well as in agriculture. We are very dependent on fossil fuel-based agriculture, where you use tons of pesticides and chemicals, which actually exacerbate the problem of climate change. But you have a whole range of sustainable agriculture options, easy, simple options, where you depend on simple, you know, community knowledge, which can actually do to transform your agriculture to organic and sustainable agriculture. So you can reduce dependence on fossil-based solutions. So there are many, many options out there that we should be advancing. I think the pressure should be much higher in terms of being much more climate-friendly than we are. I don't think we are ambitious enough.
Emission cuts can only be implemented through effective assistance with finances, technology transfer and capacity building. The Green Climate Fund, though currently not sufficient, is a good start to overcoming the barrier of finance, which presents itself as one of the obstacles for the Paris talks. In the next and final episode of COP21, we wrap up the series by discussing what to expect out of Paris 2015. Despite the challenges, how much of a milestone for climate change will COP21 be, and what should we, as a country and as a society, be preparing to do after? This is Earth Matters on BFM 89.9.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, the business station.